This is an insightview.eu podcast. In this podcast, InsightView has talked to Stig Togason, Professor Emeritus of China Studies, Aarhus University, to understand the formation of public opinion on the Chinese mainland. This is important to understand how the ongoing trade conflict between China and the United States might evolve in the coming months and years. Stig Togason went to China for the first time as a language student in 1974-1975 and has followed the transformation of Chinese society ever since. He has done fieldwork in several Chinese provinces and has published extensively on Chinese education and on political, social and cultural change in rural China. The podcast will touch on issues such as the current political power position of Xi Jinping, nationalism, and why one should not underestimate the risk of an upcoming Taiwan crisis.
Today, Washington wants to put our Western system down the throat of the Chinese, or this is how it looks like in China. This raises the question, how is Western powers perceived by ordinary Chinese people? Is it based on what the West is today or what the West was in the past?
Well, I don't think the term ordinary Chinese people makes much sense in this context. I mean, at the one end of the scale, you have millions of Chinese who have returned to China after working or studying in Western countries for many, many years. And many of them now play key roles in Chinese society. And of course, they have a very nuanced picture of the West. And then at the other end, you can still find sort of rural areas where people know practically nothing about the outside world. So if you look at the factors that sort of shape people's perceptions of the West, the large majority of Chinese people have sort of two sources of information about the West. And one is what you could call the official narrative. And this is what you get from official media and from the education system and so on. And it tells them that back in during the Opium Wars in 1840, the West attacked China. And for the next 100 years or more, we in the West consistently tried to keep China down. And then in 1949, you get the Communist Party. They make a comeback for China, and slowly they build up China again. And now China is on the rise. It's getting more prosperous. It's getting stronger in military terms and so on. And this sort of triggers the envy and the anger of the Americans, especially, and the West in general, perhaps. So now we want to keep them down. We want to check their growth. And this is the reason behind the trade war and behind all the other conflicts you see about between China and the West. So this is what you could call the meta-narrative. And it's presented to the Chinese through all sorts of media and very consistently up through the education system. And if you have this story in the back of your head, then you will interpret everything that happens now in this historical light. But of course, it's not the only source of information that Chinese people have. The other source of information is what you could call the popular media, because, I mean, through Hollywood movies and rock music and sports stars and the internet, people also get another impression of the West and what the West stands for. So these two images are sort of competing in China. Yep. And then, of course, for a limited group of people, the West also stands for sort of freedom, justice, and human rights, just like it did almost exactly 30 years ago during the demonstrations in Beijing and other cities in 1989. Of course, we don't know how many people are in this group because, for very good reasons, they keep quiet at the moment. It would be foolish of them to speak too loudly under the present system. But, I mean, I meet colleagues in China who definitely still subscribe to some of these what the Chinese officially called Western values, but more like human rights and so on. But I think generally speaking, the official narrative has been very successful in shaping people's ideas about the world.
In the last 5 years, has China's political and economic system moved further away or closer to our Western system?
It has definitely moved further away, I think. If you go back to the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s, you get a different narrative in China from what you have today when you talk about democratization and human rights. Because at that time, the story was that China is still underdeveloped, but at a certain stage, you know, when people have reached a higher level of education and when we have practiced elections, perhaps, and trained people about what democracy is, then maybe we can move sort of step by step from village elections, the election of village leaders, and then maybe to the higher levels of townships and maybe counties and so on. So you get a kind of democratization from the bottom. And this was presented as official policy, at least by some in the Communist Party leadership. You know, we want democracy, but we're not there yet. There's still some way to go. And this has changed under Xi Jinping, definitely. Now we don't get democracy as the end goal anymore. The model that is now seen as the best for China is a kind of what you could call meritocracy. So you have leaders who move up through the bureaucratic system by showing how capable they are. So you work in a county, for example, you have great results, the economy grows, that proves your worth. So you can work in the province, at the provincial level. If you perform well there, you may go even higher and so on. And in that way, you select the best leaders. And you can look at videos on the internet where the Chinese compare the electoral process in the US with the way leaders are selected in China, and claims that, you know, the Chinese model is far superior to what's happening in the West. So we've moved from, you know, at some stage we will be democratic to we don't want that kind of electoral democracy. Yeah, so in that sense, the two systems have moved further away from each other. I mean, particularly under Xi Jinping, I think that China has moved to a sort of tougher variety of authoritarianism. About 10 years ago, I wrote an article together with a Chinese colleague where we talked about the Chinese political system moving towards a kind of consultative authoritarian model. And that meant that we looked at mechanisms where the Communist Party tried to find out what do people want. You know, it could be opinion polls, it could be deliberative meetings about local budgets, how should we spend our money. It could be, you know, homepages where you could give suggestions to local leaders or complain about what happened and so on. So there were a lot of these mechanisms being developed in different places in China. And to local officials, local leaders could see that if they made experiments in this field, they would have better chances of advancing in the political system. So it was something that was looked at in a positive light. But in the later years, we have seen less of this. We don't see the same, I think, the same eagerness for integrating people's opinions in the political system. It's now more about control and surveillance.
What kind of political system is China's President Xi Jinping aiming for?
Of course, he's aiming for a strong and prosperous China under the continued control of the Chinese Communist Party. But he has not been very clear about his visions for the political system or about the political reforms that can lead to this result. I mean, the only thing we really have is his campaign against corruption. which is not really a systemic reform. It's just trying to clamp down political opponents and on, of course, people who break the rules. So it's not really a political reform. One of the catchwords in Communist Party propaganda at the moment is trust. I mean, this is connected to ideas of a harmonious society that Xi Jinping's predecessors talked a lot about. But what sort of political institutions can generate this trust between citizens and between, you know, rulers and the ruled and so on? This is a very difficult question, and I think this is what Xi Jinping is looking for. And you can see sort of the soft answer to the question, perhaps, is rolled out in the different versions of this social credit system that we have also discussed a lot in the West, right? And where we now see experiments around China, different systems, different kinds of social credit systems being implemented in different places. And then the tough versions is what we see in Xinjiang and in Tibet, with attempts of really controlling the actions and the hearts and minds of the population through a kind of strict surveillance and merciless suppression. So if we want to know what more about Xi Jinping's political visions, I think we need to look at the kind of control that's exercised through the social credit system. Because that was generated actually mainly for its economic aspects. There were no other ways in China of knowing whether this guy perhaps had already had a debt of millions of yuan, or if he was trustworthy in terms of credit. So in that sense, it made good sense in the economic field, but now it's sort of expanded also to the social and political field. And if you look at that, I think you get a system where citizens sort of keep an eye on each other. So it's not up to the state necessarily to survey everybody, but they get ordinary citizens to take part in the surveillance. And that's not foreign to Chinese political thought. If you look back at Imperial China, the bureaucracy, the central bureaucracy, was quite limited. So if you went to the villages or towns and so on, it was very much up to the clans and the lineages and the families to keep order and to take care of those who... of criminal offenders and keep law and order in local communities. So people were supposed to keep an eye on each other. And I think that the sort of visions Xi Jinping has perhaps goes in this direction. A society where people share the values of the Communist Party and the state, and they're willing to keep an eye on each other. To make sure that everybody stay inside that framework.
In this context, has the latest development made our two systems incompatible?
Yeah, I think we have to see this also in a larger global context, because it's not only in China that we see strong authoritarian leaders gaining more power at the moment, right? It also happens in political systems with sort of relatively free and open elections. So the whole idea about all nations heading towards some sort of Western-style liberal democracy, that whole idea is definitely under pressure. Now, you sometimes hear that China analysts or China experts used to believe that China would sooner or later become, you know, just like us. But I don't think that accusation is quite fair. If you go back and read what China experts predicted back in the 80s and 90s. I mean, of course, there were a few people who made such arguments, but most researchers emphasized that the Communist Party would never dream of giving up its power. I mean, that would be so much against their political nature, right? But many of us expected, I think, a more open political debate, more freedom of expression, perhaps. We also expected, I think, a more independent judicial system, which has not happened either, and perhaps more channels for public influence on the political process. And at that time, we could actually point to trends in that direction towards more openness and public influence. But that was not the trend that would win out in the longer run, right? So in that sense, the political systems of China and the West have moved further away from each other under Xi Jinping.
Is there dissent within the Communist Party when it comes to President Xi Jinping's policy direction? If so, what kind of dissent?
It's always been very difficult for outsiders to find out what kind of dissent you have in the highest political bodies of the People's Republic. I mean, sometimes it gets out into the open, like in the case of Bo Xilai in 2012. But in most cases, we only know about sort of networks. We know, you know, these people work together in the Youth League, these people work together in Shanghai, and then we presume that they have common interests, or, you know, these people are based in the energy sector and the oil sector and so on. So we try to find out how these networks influence Chinese politics. But when it comes to ideologically based fractions, it is very, very difficult to penetrate, like the Central Committee and even higher bodies than that. We've not been very successful in doing that at any time, and I cannot at this moment identify any clear dissent within the core leadership of the Communist Party.
How has the relationship between the Chinese people and the Communist Party evolved under the leadership of Xi Jinping, who supports the president?
I think his campaign against corruption has been quite successful, in the sense that it's strengthened his popularity generally. Corruption has always been one of the major points of complaints. I mean, when I've talked to people up through the 1980s and 90s and 2000s, you know, we always heard these endless stories about corruption, even from people inside the political system, but of course even more from farmers and workers and so on. So that part of his rule has gained popularity through this campaign against corruption. Of course, there are also people who say that he's just using the campaign to get rid of his opponents in the system, and that may be correct, but I think to most people this is a quite successful move. I also think that his ability to present China as a kind of coming power that's on its way up, that takes up the challenge from the US and is ready to stand firm on all international issues and so on. I think that's also generally accepted by a large part of the population. Of course, there's also opposition. I mean, there are people who don't like the way the political system is developing, and you still see on the Chinese internet, in spite of all censorship and all that, you still see critical voices and very sort of ironic and sarcastic comments to Xi Jinping's policies and his performances. But it's very difficult to measure sort of quantitatively how wide this kind of dissent is. You get a few people who are very outspoken. There are groups of lawyers, for example, who still insist on taking up these human rights-based issues and still defend, Falun Gong practitioners and migrant workers and, all kinds of marginal groups. But they are, of course, a very small minority. And we have opinion polls made in China, also by international groups whose methodology is considered to be quite good and reliable, and they tend to show quite a large, massive support actually for the central leadership. So you still have this pattern which has been general in China up through the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, that you get high level of support for the central government, and then for each level you go down, you get less support. So that when you asked about, you know, do you trust your local leader in this township or in this county, you get a rather low level of support. But once you get to the central leadership, you get a much higher level of support. But that's as close as we can get, because without a public sphere with an open debate and with all the censorship we have in China, with all the surveillance mechanisms, it's very difficult to measure sort of quantitatively what do people actually think about Xi Jinping.
Beijing wants entrepreneurship and innovation, not least in the tech sector. How does Beijing, being in control of everything, fits into the context that innovation requires often more and not less freedom of speech?
Yeah, that's a question I've been thinking about a lot, actually, because I did some research on Chinese kindergartens and kindergarten teachers to find out what are sort of the basic values that you try to instill in Chinese children. And of course, creativity, entrepreneurship are among these values that are really emphasized at this stage, at least in theory. So when I interviewed the Chinese kindergarten teachers, they would tell me that this is where China could really learn a lot from the West, because they thought that all Chinese children were told to obey. Their children would help, sort of their parents would help them putting on their clothes and feeding them and so on, where they would see, in this case, Danish children who would learn to do all these things from very young age, right? Eat with their own spoon, even though the food would spread everywhere, and put on their own clothes, even though it would not be perfect and so on, and make creative drawings instead of just following a pattern from what the teacher has been drawing. And all these things, they found that this sort of individuality and creativity that they saw in the West was extremely inspiring for China. And that's not just their personal opinion. You also find that if you look at the official Chinese debate in psychology, in pedagogics, and teaching, and so on, which should have more creative, innovative individuals. And sort of logically, it collides with, like you said, with these ideas of control and state dominance. To me, these two ideas are also more or less incompatible, but then I think we should remember that when we first heard about the economic reforms, that you could actually, I mean, the idea of privatizing the economy and still maintaining the control of the Communist Party, right? That the Communist Party, I mean, how would they ever be able to control a privatized economy? But they somehow managed to do that. And maybe we will see the same with creativity, individuality, that you can have quite, you know, innovative individuals who are creative in the economic sphere, but still accept the leadership of the state, still accept the norms and values promoted by the Communist Party. I mean, I wouldn't exclude that beforehand.
Today, Beijing's global influence has risen, reinforced by the Belt and Road Initiative. Furthermore, Beijing has significant territorial claims in the South China Sea. Is President Xi's assertive style on the global scene supported on the mainland?
I think generally there's a lot of support, because most people see Xi Jinping not as a representative of the Chinese Communist Party, but as a representative of China. So he's sort of speaking for China. And like other places in the world, you know, you tend to support your own country and think that the others are wrong and you are right. So Xi Jinping is not so much seen as a representative of a political party or a special policy even, but he's seen more as a representative of China. And I also think that if you look at this massive narrative that we talked about in the beginning, that is constantly telling people this story about China as the rising power that is being kept down by the US, who don't want to see any new rival and so on, and that China and that everything can be interpreted inside this framework, then you can understand that people support sort of more hardline foreign policy from Xi Jinping. And I think I can see that even among my colleagues in China. When I used to discuss these issues with my Chinese colleagues, like back in the 90s and 2000s, I think I heard much more support of Western views on the world order and how the world was organized. Whereas now, I think many people have accepted this meta-narrative that China has a natural place in the world and the US is trying to keep China down so that they cannot take back this natural position.
In the context of the trade war, nationalism appears yet again to be on the rise in China. In a historical perspective, how comes that nationalism always appears to be just below the surface in China?
I think there are two sides of this. One is that there is a what you could call a popular nationalism, and it's connected to the narrative we just talked about, where people see that China is still has not achieved the position that it really deserves. And that it's been sort of humiliated by the Japanese, by the Western powers, and so on. That's one side of it. The other side is that nationalism can be mobilized, it can be organized from above to reach certain political targets. It can be controlled, not without dangers, because it can also become too fierce or too trendy, so that it may even threaten the Communist Party. But you can try to keep it under control, and we've seen several cases of this, especially in the relation to Japan, where the Communist Party has mobilized young people to demonstrate against Japanese goods. They encouraged boycotts also against French supermarkets and so on. It's a very delicate balance, because on the one hand you can use these nationalist youth to put a pressure on the outside world and companies and states and so on. On the other hand, you don't want people to you wouldn't allow people to organize their own demonstrations or their own protests. So you have to, because nationalism can turn against the state. If, for example, the Chinese Communist Party was not assertive enough in certain conflicts because they could see that it would be too dangerous or too economically costly and so on, nationalism could become a pressure and even dangerous to the Communist Party. So it's a kind of controlled state nationalism could be used by the Communist Party also in this conflict.
How do you expect the China-US relationship to develop in the coming years?
Well, there are many factors here, but if I should focus on one issue that I see as particularly dangerous, it would be the Taiwan issue. On the one hand, you have the Chinese Communist Party, who are really looking for a reunification with Taiwan and is working very hard on that. On the other hand, you have Taiwanese political parties and the Chinese population who've got used to democratic freedoms and the sort of liberties that we know from Western societies, and who can sort of look at Hong Kong and see how this whole idea of one country, two systems is deteriorating at the moment. I mean, I was in Hong Kong recently, and I could feel that many academics in particular had very, very severe doubts about the future for academic freedom, for political freedom, and so on. So if I was sitting on Taiwan and looking at Hong Kong, I would be really scared. At the same time, I don't think we realize perhaps how serious the Communist Party is taking this issue. I mean, for them, it is a very, very substantial goal. And I don't think they're bluffing when they are talking about, you know, there's only one China and we will reunite. And this is an issue where I can't see the solution, and where there are so many American interests and so much American prestige also invested in Taiwan, that could be a point of contention that could be extremely dangerous in the future.
Thank you, Steve Thurston, for taking part in this podcast.